Woo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And we're feeling so alive over here on this Tuesday.
We're feeling alive. Why is that, Megan?
Because we're literally alive. I had to address the very mangled elephant in the room. Yeah, the elephant with a trunk that looks a little sketch.
Oh, that is true. My trunk is pretty messed up.
Okay. Which part of your trunk?
Oh, actually, the whole trunk is pretty messed up, but especially the nose trunk. Yeah. The nose trunk, what does it look like right now? What are you looking back at?
It looks sexy. Like a sideways diagonal scar.
Uh-huh.
And I like it. It's like Harry Potter migrated to your nose.
Oh, Harry Potter turns you on.
It does. Yeah. It's a little embarrassing, but it does.
I'm putting that hog into Hogwarts is what you're saying over here. Okay, thanks. We have to start off with that. Why am I a mangled elephant, Megan?
Well, in a little bit of weird reality. So last week we talked about on the podcast, like cars coming really fast in our faces.
Yeah.
And a car came really fucking slow in your face. And you sadly, it's been a rough week.
Yeah.
But you're alive and we're doing it. Do you want to give the full story?
Well, for our listeners that don't follow on social media, basic gist of it is I was just traveling straight on a dead straight road at 25 miles an hour.
Actually, like one of the most beautiful cycling roads in Boulder.
Nelson Road here in Boulder.
I've probably ridden it 450 times.
Yeah.
Like super wide shoulder, beautiful road. We actually went there last night. Gorgeous sunset. So yeah, keep going.
Yeah, we went back there last night. We'll get to that in a second. And a car appeared just in my left peripheral vision as I was just riding straight. And the last I remember is trying to skid off to the right. And then I woke up in the ambulance 30 or 40 minutes later. So we'll get to that in a second. I'm fine. I'll be okay. Don't worry about me. I might be a little bit mangled here, but otherwise I'm strong as hell.
Your brain is not mangled though.
Okay. Yeah.
You were unconscious for 30 minutes and somehow came out of that like a brilliant human being.
Yeah.
There was like a 24-hour lag. You repeated yourself a lot within the first 24 hours. And I got slightly worried that this was going to be our reality of the podcast going forward. But now it's like, man, things are rapid firing. It's beautiful.
In real life, it's called repeating yourself. On a podcast, it's called a callback.
Yes, that's true.
So it's perfect. Actually, my secret theory here is I wasn't actually suffering a concussion. What happened is when I got hit, I had a spontaneous nap. I was just like very tired. Parenting's hard sometimes. And what's really weird is I was dreaming totally lucidly while I was passed out, getting treated by all these fire trucks and police cars and ambulances and everything. And then also after I woke up, I felt like I was smarter than ever. I understand head injuries are very serious, and I actually had one that was very serious in high school. And after that one, I had 2 years where the world spun, where I had all the post-concussion symptoms, and where I think I permanently lost like 20 IQ points that I'll never get back. After this one, I think I woke up smarter. I think it knocked everything back into place.
I was going to say, maybe it restored it in you.
Yeah.
Maybe you got resurrected and your brain came back smarter. We talked about that in the podcast.
Jokes.
I know. Oh. You got trucked. You got risen. You came back.
Yeah.
Now you're ready to take the SAT.
I got flown.
Yes.
Okay, let's just get straight to the roadmap so we can talk more about this, because I think a lot of interesting takeaways from almost dying. So the first, gratitude to be alive, a little bit of a breakdown of some of the things that happened, what we learned. Then extreme fueling in the cycling peloton, shoe reviews, really fun stuff there. College basketball thoughts, we've been really watching Caitlin Clark in the women's college tournament. Zone 2 training, a steep climbing tutorial, a book recommendation, hot takes, and more.
I'm so excited to dive into all of this, especially talking about you being alive, obviously. I'm still processing it on many levels, but also Caitlin Clark.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the two of those side by side? Like women's basketball right now is just, it is great.
Yeah.
It is good, good stuff.
Maybe while I was knocked out, I almost feel like everything we got to see Caitlin Clark and the other women in the tournament do was part of the dream.
I hope you were just shooting threes in your dreams and just making like half court shots and being like, Caitlin Clark.
What was so weird is I was dreaming of us. And so let's go back to the accident. So it was a great ride. I was feeling really good. Megan and I had actually run into each other earlier on the ride for just a little bit and rode with each other. And so when I came to with, I don't know, 20 or 30 people around me, and I couldn't look around or anything. But I was like, oh no, I was in an accident. Like, you know, everyone plays through this. And the first thing I remember thinking is, Megan. Was Megan riding with me? I didn't remember what date it was. I didn't remember my name at that time.
Actually, at one point, you told me that when the paramedics asked you some questions and they asked you what month it was, you're like, what is a month?
Yeah.
Your brain was just on such a good level that it was going straight, like, philosophical mode.
Yeah, existential to the max. So what happened is I got hit, apparently. We just looked at the police report yesterday, which confirms what we suspected. by this car that just made a left turn and did not see me. It was an 89-year-old driver, unfortunately.
Which I actually, it's wild because last week we were talking about the fact that like you like taking the tangents when you like run, when you run.
Fortunately, she wanted to take the tangents.
I know. Well, I had the moment. So
she listened.
She listened. Well, I had a moment, and we'll get to this in a second, where I was like biking to the hospital and I was like, motherfucker took the tangents, referring to you.
Oh, you thought it might have been
me. I thought it was you, but then I was like, you know, maybe he was going for a Strava segment. So it's like all is fair in love and tangents. But you are riding, I think this is like the really hard reality of biking, is you were literally doing everything right. You're just riding straight on a straight road when this like green Subaru came right into your path. And I think that's like the harsh, harsh reality of biking sometimes.
Maybe the way I'm managing it so well is because I wasn't going for a Strava segment. If I got launched 100 feet in the air, which is what all the police reports said, 100 feet in the air and had hit a fence, and I didn't get the Strava segment, that would be a big problem for me. But just getting launched 100 feet, I'm like, hey, I always dreamed of flying when I was a little boy. And now, yes, it was non-consensual and spontaneous and very temporary, but still, it was flight.
Do you remember the flight?
No, my memory stops when as the police report said, I took an evasive maneuver to the right.
Which actually sounds like an extremely athletic maneuver. Kudos. It might be why you're alive right now.
I like that they use the word evasive. And not like cowardly. This coward tried to bail.
So this real coward bitch.
So I tried to bail, and going through my head the whole time, everyone's felt this. Like everyone's had these types of close calls. I was like, they're going to see me. They're going to see me. Because it was clear they didn't see me. And I guess they didn't see me. So I felt a rumble, which I thought at the time was, you know, going off the road. But in reality, it was probably my dream bike getting hit by this car. And that was the last memory I have. And then all of this is filled in. I didn't remember this right away. It's filled in over time. So who knows how much is what I heard versus what I actually experienced. But then, came to in the ambulance. Apparently, three different police departments showed up at the site. So the state police, two county police, which is a sign that they think they're going to see something a little bit worse than I ended up experiencing, which was the severe concussion, broken wrist, you know, banged up all over, for the most part, some facial lacerations. But otherwise, I mean, coming out of that alive is just immensely, immensely lucky.
Oh, you got so lucky, like wildly lucky. And I think we're both still processing that.
It's what we're saying is this 89-year-old driver, spiritual teacher.
I don't quite know about that, but it is. I mean, so yesterday when we got the police report, we were like scrolling through the police report and all of a sudden we see the date of the birth of the driver and it's 1935. And my brain was like, damn, that's, and I guess what was interesting, because I was, you know, as I heard about this accident, strangely, one of the first things that popped into my head was how terrible it would be to be that driver.
Definitely.
Like, I don't think anyone starts their day and is like, I'm going to go truck a biker.
Oh, no. And it's not her fault.
It's not her fault at all.
This
and
shit
it's
happens
like,
in, like, I want to reach out to her as soon as I can to just let her know, Miriam, that it's okay. Like, you know, this type of thing is part of existence and, you know,
it also happens. I mean, sometimes it's like, you know, we've all had those moments sometimes where you're driving and you're like, oh, I wish I didn't make that move,
and
or something.
Usually they amount to nothing.
Exactly.
Like, it's not an intentional thing. And I feel like, I don't know, life's too short. And given that she's 89, life's not too long in a literal sense. I just don't want her to carry any guilt. And at the end of the day, like, this is probably the best outcome that could possibly happen from that situation. Like, so, okay, this happens. I'm in the ambulance. Don't remember anything, but I do remember Megan's phone number, which is a sign that I must have been really encoding into you. I heard from the paramedics and stuff. It's like, you can stop telling us how much you love Megan.
Well, okay, so this happened. So we were riding together.
Yeah.
And I was waiting for you. I was like kind of figuring where, so I turned around a little bit early. I was riding a gravel bike. You were riding a road bike. And I
got those watts, son.
I know. And so I was like waiting for you to come catch me, thinking about the route that you were going to ride. Yeah. I didn't know what route you're going to ride, but I could kind of like approximate it in my head. And you weren't passing me. And I was like, this is strange. Like, I feel like David should pass me by now. And then as I'm continuing to bike, literally every siren in Boulder is coming the opposite direction as I'm biking. And I just had this like weird, uncomfortable feeling about that, like knowing you were out there, knowing
what
you should have passed me.
In your head, was it that something happened to me?
Oh, it was like 100%. But I was trying to talk myself off that ledge. I'm like, Megan, don't be ridiculous. Yeah. Like, you see sirens all the time. He's fine. He's okay. And then like 10 minutes later, I get a phone call from a 303 number and I never answer my phone.
Yeah.
Like if I answer my phone, it's like there is someone I know who's calling me, or there's like a prearranged call.
We're classic millennials. A call is an act of aggression.
Especially when I'm riding. I was riding pretty fast and I like pulled over to the side of the road for whatever reason, took this phone call. And worst phone call of my life is like, Megan, this is the fire department is all they say. And like, you know, I'm having this context of all of these, like, you know, ambulances, fire trucks, police, like police cars coming into my way. And, but it was also the best when they told me that you were conscious. Then they went a step further and they're like, he was the nicest guy when he came to, he was making the funniest jokes. And then in my head, I was like, okay, he's going to be okay. But it was still like the world's worst call to receive.
Okay. You know what makes me feel a little better about myself?
What?
It's like all people, I think sometimes I have the internal monologue that is a little more evil than my external facing self, right?
I for sure do.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes when that happens, I'm like, am I secretly a bad person that acts like a good person? But then when I'm fully like just coming out of being unconscious and don't remember a thing and was repeating myself constantly, they said I was so kind and funny. I'm like, maybe I actually am a good person in real life.
Multiple people said that. Yeah. So I got this news and I was like 8 miles away from the hospital and I was doing the math in my head. I'm like, it's going to be faster if I just bike there.
Yeah.
Like I got to bike to the hospital. And fortunately, like in your act of love and kindness, I feel like you spiritually did this to the universe. It got me right to 50 miles as I biked, like literally like 50.5, right as I biked into the trauma unit. And I was like, he's gifting me the most perfect 50 mile bike ride biking into the trauma unit. But
when I saw that you got to 50 miles, I zoomed in on that Strava immediately to see if you did parking lap loops around emergency department.
Do you know how fast I biked? I was like, it was such a blur, but I was biking so fast to get there. But when I like literally biked into the trauma department, three nurses came to me and they're like, you have the nicest husband. And it was just, it was so cool. I mean, it's like, David, it's a reflection of your character and integrity that you're in this like severe accident and you're just exuding love and kindness and humor.
You know what's actually a reflection of my character and integrity?
What?
That I got the Strava. I still stopped that segment. Megan opened my phone like 5 hours later and it's like, David, your Strava is still on this phone because I leave it running in the background on the bike sometimes. So I have a backup just in case something like this happens.
Just in case you get trucked by a Subaru.
So that Strava exists and it is good.
Actually, it exists and you can see, it's actually quite helpful for the accident because you can see where you make that like evasive maneuver and then where there's like where you flew. And then there's like tons of back and forth activity, which I think is them carrying you on the stretcher, which sadly got added to your like overall moving time.
I would have been faster.
You would have been so much faster.
I was 21.2 miles an hour. I thought I was over 22. So this makes me feel better. My head might be gone, but my fitness is still there. Okay. So we wound up in the hospital and we're going to just abbreviate the rest of the story. I think basically the big conclusion for me is this type of shit happens. And as much as I wish it didn't, and as much as like, you know, there's all this blaming of self or blame or how, what if this went differently and all of that in the process? It's like, at the end of the day, this is part of what adds meaning and texture to life is taking these chances, these small chances and big chances that let you live a big life. And I want to keep doing that.
Well, it's kind of wild. And I think this is the hard part that I have to conceptualize is that biking on a wide open road on a shoulder is to some extent a chance.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that we've thought about. And I've especially thought about it since baby Leo has come into the world is I ride a lot more gravel now than I do road, but even that is still a chance.
Yeah.
And how do you feel like, how is it going to feel to get back into the saddle and bike again?
I have two reflections.
What?
One is, get busy living or get busy dying. I feel the need for speed. No, I mean, on that, I just think that, you know, this is life. And as much as I want to control things and like, I'm not a daredevil in life.
I'm not at all. Yeah.
And I mean,
when I say that you take the running tangents, like on Magnolia Road running,
you're
also so careful in that process too.
To a certain extent, but I guess my big point is we're all carrying background risk all the time.
Oh yeah. Driving your car to the grocery store is some level of background risk. Yeah.
You know, any of us could have cancer right now. Like this type of experience, which honestly is a true near-death experience. When I heard that I flew 100 feet, I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. And then seeing the police reports that diagrammed 100 feet of flight, then including dropping 8 to 10 feet into a ditch and hitting a fence and surviving that, let alone my legs are fine. The most important thing for a runner, as soon as I woke up, I was like, my legs. And it's like, good to go.
I actually asked that on the side of the road. I was like, how's his pelvis? How are his legs? And they're like, we think it's fine.
Like, it's so weird. Like I have gotten hurt this year running up the stairs to test the Coros heart rate iron monitor band. Meanwhile, I fly over 100 feet into a fence, legs fine right now. What the hell is up with my body?
I know. It's like such a miracle. Granted, that fence. So we went back and saw the site last night.
We reclaimed it.
And it was beautiful. There was a sunset out there. It was like, honestly, the most beautiful spot to have an accident. Like it was super grassy.
A wonderful spot to die.
Yeah. You've been making a lot of morbid jokes and I've had to stop you.
I made sure that Megan would promise me that if I died, she would coach Grayson Murphy.
Yeah. Actually, I said that first.
Yeah.
We had this conversation.
Well, then I made sure that you would also coach Drew Holman and Ali Ostrander.
You were also making sure I was going to continue to podcast. I was like, I don't think I can do that.
I told you a number of different partners that would be acceptable to replace me on the podcast. I also need to get life insurance.
Yeah. Oh, but it was, but we went back and saw the spot last night after having these morbid conversations. And then I woke up at 3 a.m. last night and was a little jarred by all of this. But the spot was so beautiful. And it was like grassy. And it was just one of those reflections of going back and like luck and gratitude to get to do this sport at all. Yeah. And I'm so glad, like after you recovered and like things seemed to be okay, I was so happy that you're going to continue biking. Like again, because I feel like our bike memories, like the long rides that we've done together have been so special.
Yeah.
And so right now I'm working on reassembling your dream bike.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the dream bike is dead.
The dream bike is very dead. The handlebars are like, like facing each other.
The rear of the framework got hit, crunched.
It looks like it went through the paper shredder.
Yeah.
But so on Friday I was making a bunch of calls, like working on getting this bike replaced as soon as possible. I was like, he's in a sling, but I think he's going to need it in 6 days for the trainer. And it was actually like, I came down and told you this news and
it's the only time I got emotional.
You cried. I know. Process. And I started crying too. And I'm just so glad you're going to get back on that dream bike. And I think it is a reflection and like in life is like, you have to live and it's hard. And I think I'm more prone to like safety fears than other people. Like, you know, my mind goes to this when I see fire engines and, you know, it's a reminder to myself that we have to live too.
Yeah. Well, there's a great Lonely Island song called YOLO. If you haven't heard it, go listen to it. And essentially what there are, YOLO, you only live once, is used in like by Drake when he came out with it, of the idea of like, you only live once, go have fun, right? And that's kind of the way I like it. But the way Lonely Island took it was YOLO, so don't do anything dangerous. Like wrap yourself in bubble wrap because YOLO, you got to be careful. And I mean, I think that just points out that like, no, wrapping yourself in bubble wrap is the opposite way of how like a life is well lived. And you know, I've had to work so hard at overcoming my anxiety outside of all of this. And the one place where I have resolved not to have anxiety is in like physical frailty, because like it is coming. It is coming for all of us. Like whether it is a car coming in your peripheral vision, or it is cancer, or it is old age, or it is your heart, or anything, it is coming for all of us. And if we spend our time preoccupied with how to prevent those risks, and this goes for people that try to control their food intake a ton, all of this stuff too, it's like, then you're going to not actually live with the time you have. So, you know, I like to think that as I was flying through the air, I was just like, yo, or I believe I can fly.
You were probably like, you are amazing as you were flying through the air.
Don't worry about it.
I'm okay. You'll be okay. Well, I've gotten to see. So I do think like all of us aside, I do think you're probably going to have hand and wrist surgery. We find this out this afternoon.
Yeah.
So fingers crossed, hoping for your hand and wrist, but you've been dictating on the computer.
Yes.
And it's been, cause you can't type, and it's been such a like, the amount of joy and enthusiasm that you have when you're writing Patreon messages or like you're in the training logs, it's been really inspirational to me. And it's fun because like Leo is sleeping upstairs. I'm like, yo, David, keep your voice down. Yeah. You're like, your levels of like excitement are building and rising as you're dictating these. And it's also just a fun reflection on loving what you do.
Hot take. This was all worth it to learn the magic of dictation apps.
You're good at it.
I'm getting better.
No, I mean, it takes, I mean, you got to be like, you got to say a sentence, then you insert a comma, and then you're
filter words.
Double exclamation point. It's quite good.
Yeah. And the main thing I learned is that if I say huzzah, it comes out H-A-Z-A, exclamation point, which is not how you spell it. Instead, I have to enunciate it, huzzah, and exclamation point. How can you be mad when you're writing huzzah all the time? Okay. So a couple more reflections on this actually before we get to the main topics today. First, most satisfying experience of my life was face was covered in blood. Obviously, we have some pictures online. But after I got out of the hospital, my nose was also filled with dried blood. You know what that felt like?
What?
Most satisfying booger experience in the history of my life. I will never forget it.
Okay. I'm a doctor. And so there's very few things that gross me out. That kind of grosses me out.
Oh, Megan.
Thinking about you just like blowing those boogers of blood.
give me something. Give me something. It was some of our listeners out there will fully identify with that experience. Just know that if you ever go into a really bad accident and your face is covered in blood, there are benefits that you might not predict. Other is the wrist has actually been maybe one of the most painful things I've ever experienced. Like consistent 10 out of 10 pain for an extended period of time.
Which is, you're so tough too. So when you say 10 out of 10 pain, it's actually jarring to me. I'm like, what is going on in that wrist? We have an MRI that we're waiting on the results of.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I almost feel like my brain, when it got scrambled, the pain signals rewired as it relates to my wrist, because it shouldn't hurt this much based on my history with broken bones and things like that. I mean, my collarbone practically is a sundial right now. Like it sticks out like 3 inches from when I've broken it. And so I've been desperate there. Like I actually went in on Friday and you know, they tried in the emergency room to give me oxycodone or serious painkiller like that, an opiate, and I refused it, you know, because I've watched the Dope Sick documentary. I want to avoid this type of stuff in general. But on Friday, I was like, I actually need it. And so I took it for a couple days as needed when it went, hit 10 out of 10. And honestly, didn't do all that much relative to like anti-inflammatories. And then my parents brought down some THC CBD mixture. And I know we've talked about that before. And sometimes maybe weren't the most supportive of that. But I was like, fuck, for chronic pain, it was way better for me than oxycodone.
Yeah, sleep has been really hard for you. Yeah. So like I've been sleeping next to you and it's like tossing and turning and like making noises. And then like sometimes getting up and like dropping bottles in the middle of the night. Like there's a lot going on.
All sex dreams. Yeah. Including the bottle. Like everything. And that's a walking sex dream.
Did you have any sex dreams when you're unconscious?
Oh, no.
That would be so wild.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine?
While the paramedics in?
That would be epic. That would be amazing. Actually, one of the best moments was in the hospital. Yeah. I had to help you pee and like use the urinal as you're like in this like neck brace and things worked. And I got so excited. I was like, the trunk works. The nose is mangled, but the trunk works.
Hogwarts. School is in session. Yeah. But the most painful thing of all for me was the wrist MRI. They took my hand, turned it sideways and stuck it between this panini press motherfucking device and then compressed it. I'm like, how is this the only way we can MRI broken wrists? It was terrible.
I know. I feel like actually, as I think about the physics of how like the magnets go around, I feel like it should be able to do it in any orientation. Yeah. I mean, I'm probably wrong. Like they've probably thought about this 8,000 times, but I do feel like it takes a broken bone to really think about it. You're like, this could be better.
Yeah. And I had a DMX playlist yet again. The techs got a great joy out of it. And every single time DMX would like bark, I'd be like, ruff, ruff, I'm with you. And then final reflection here is that Megan forced me to buy top of the line technological helmet before
this
event.
A MIPS helmet. So you were riding, you had this like dream bike that was amazing. And then you were riding with a freaking like Teletubby helmet. It was huge. It looked like it wasn't going to do anything. And it was only like 4 weeks ago that I made you buy the MIPS helmet. And we had like a long discussion about it.
I don't like
store.
To spend money.
Yeah.
And you probably saved my life. Yeah. Realistically, based on what happened to the helmet, what happened to the fence. I mean, the helmet was covered with the fence residue and the fence was broken. And like, thank you. Thank you for looking out for me and knowing when I need to be, you know, chastised a little bit.
Well, it always makes sense. I feel like if you're out there and you don't have a MIPS helmet, definitely get a MIPS helmet. But here's my thing is like, we actually haven't talked about this that much is so that morning that you went out to ride, you're going to go downstairs to the trainer and do a Zwift race.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful out. It was sunny. I was going out to ride outside on my gravel bike. And I told you, I was like, David, like you should just ride outside. It's beautiful. I didn't want you to like heart rate going to like 180 on a Zwift race. And I was like, it'd be so fun to go ride outside. And as I was like hammering to the hospital, like waiting to go meet you in the trauma unit, my brain went to that. And I was like, I'm so sorry. Like I told you to go right outside. But then it also went to the fact that like, you're the type of person, and this is why I love you so much, is like, you wouldn't give a shit about that. And it brings me back to like all the times when like, you know, we've had rough stuff going on and I never as a partner feel like I have to give you the perfect day or the perfect experience. Yeah. And to know that you wouldn't carry that with you means the world, but I'm still carrying it with me.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, Megan, you're the reason that I live life, right? So I've already lived more life now at 35 than I would have without you to 100 or to 89. Let's say.
Yeah, hopefully you get to 89.
Yeah, hopefully.
Then you stop driving.
Yeah. So you filled my life cup, my soul cup to the max. And literally, even if you drove the car, I wouldn't blame you, let alone if you got me out there and had a great ride. You know, I was feeling so good and having so much fun. And that day, as much as I wish I didn't get hit by a car, like it was a great day. We had a lot of fun in the emergency room, I feel like. Yeah. After everything settled, like that was a joy. We connected with the staff. We got to make jokes. You know, just gratitude to be alive.
Well, it's also kind of wild too. We shared an amazing like few miles together at Rabbit Mountain as I like tried to hold on your wheel on a gravel bike and you were hauling on your road bike. And my brain goes to those memories. But it's interesting how like when someone goes through trauma, you replay what happens that morning. And we had such like a loving and amazing morning. I actually have like, I have a picture of you and Leo that I looked at like right when I got to the hospital. I was like, oh, I'm crying right now. And it's just wild how like the hours before the event almost get like encapsulated in the mind. But I thought about those miles shared together with you on the bike and I'm excited to share a lot more.
I love you so much. And the added benefit, I've had to be less of a good parent recently, so I can't really do much. So I'm getting to catch up on work and stuff because I can't really carry Leo. Then I'm getting better at doing the one arm carry. So you know, maybe I did this all along just to avoid a little bit of work.
Actually, you've been crushing the coaching work and the podcast work. Like, you did your whole podcast outline dictating. It's very impressive.
And that gets to a little bit of a scientific topic here. For my brain, the response here has been wildly good. And I don't know why. Like, I'm being very careful. I'm just staying zone one. I've actually been able to run in this little sling, which is pretty epic if I do say so myself.
Oh, it's super epic. It scares me like slightly, but I'm like, okay, Megan, look past that. But seeing you run up the driveway in the sling is one of the most inspirational, badass things I've seen. It's amazing.
As my wrist gets even more severely displaced, I'm just like, yo,
fitness.
Give me THC. One of the reasons I think this could be the case is there's some really interesting research on the use of ketones in traumatic brain injury patients. So this isn't a scientific deep dive or anything, but I wanted to think about how I can most, you know, facilitate brain healing. And there was actually a Patreon listener, Erin, who we love, who got in a severe accident recently, and her doctors recommended ketones for the recovery process.
What kind of ketones do they recommend? Do you know?
Ketone monoesters.
Yes, yeah.
Which isn't HAMN ketone IQ, but to me, it's very interesting because, you know, I have been taking this stuff. It crosses the blood-brain barrier and can be helpful perhaps for nourishment of the brain in these traumatic states. So maybe there's something there. I think I'm taking one a day right now just to stay on top of it. And I feel really intellectually stable, which is the most you can ask for. Like, everything else, you know, as much as we joke about the legs being okay and stuff, it all comes back to the brain being okay.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The brain being able to, like, for you to be able to communicate and to make jokes, it's like the best thing ever. But what I love about this is, I don't know if you know this, but in the first 24 hours, you were repeating yourself a lot and it kind of like gradually started to decline. Uh-huh. But you probably told me about ketones and the pathways of ketones to brain healing 15 times. I should have recorded it on Thursday. You told me it in like the emergency room 4 times. And then we got home and you told me it to me 5 more times. And each time I was like, yeah, it's going to work.
Those are just my callbacks. I was just trying to tag some jokes. That's all I was trying to do.
Can you actually fill us in on, so I've heard this 15 times now, and I actually think even on the 15th time, it was really cool. So can you describe a little bit of the science behind like what they're thinking in terms of how ketones impact? So like when you get a traumatic brain injury, like brain metabolism and brain cellular processes happen in different phases.
Yeah.
And actually it's kind of fascinating to think about the overlap between ketones and that like pathophysiology of what's going wrong in the brain.
So this is really experimental still and theoretical. A lot of these studies are done in mice, which is really important to say because like we're not going to, you know, cause a TBI to a human. Though it's unfortunate to know what we're doing to mice.
I know, it's actually really sad. But did you know that the best TBI models that like are parallel to humans are actually in pigs?
Oh.
Which is really sad because their brain like composition and structure and morphology is much more similar to humans than mice.
Our listeners didn't need to know that.
I know, it's really sad. It's like, I know. Okay. I really am sad about driving Subarus into pigs, but yes.
Okay, so here's a quote from one of the big review studies that just came out. Ketones can help combat post-traumatic cerebral energy deficits while also reducing inflammation, oxidative stress, and neurodegeneration. Experimental models of TBI suggest that administering ketones to TBI patients may provide significant benefits to improve recovery. So important there is to say it's experimental rather than like, you know, evidence-based in the field with active TBI patients. A lot more stuff is coming on that. But for me personally, like, as I've taken one, I've actually felt a slight change in how my brain has recovered from this. And I have been blown away. Having had a severe brain injury before when I was in high school, I got airlifted.
You were unconscious for how long that time?
I woke up in the helicopter. I don't know exactly
how long.
Probably
similar amounts of time.
Yeah. And, you know, one, my brain might be good at shutting off. And the spontaneous naps are very strong in me.
Spontaneous naps and sex dreams. Your brain excels in.
Oh, God. My dad was in the helicopter with me that time. Yeah. Oh, Freud would have had a field day with that one. But, you know, in this one, my recovery process has been just by different, I mean, I'm not joking when I say I feel smarter than before the accident and I do not understand what happened. Like, I feel so lucky in that regard that I've had zero post-concussion symptoms. And in fact, like I am feeling my brain is on fire.
Well, do you think it has any relation to anxiety? Like, I feel like sometimes on these events, there is a uptick in like safety related, almost like PTSD related anxiety. Yeah. But I feel like some of the background anxiety of day-to-day life clears. Like I think I've even seen that for me. It's like, you know, I've had anxiety about like random ass stuff and now it's like not coming up because it's filled with like more important things, quite frankly. Like, do you think there's any relation between how your brain is firing and changes in mental health?
So when the Mongols are at the gates, you're not worried about something you messed up in seventh grade.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I think there is something to that. And I think I'm really good in crisis mode in general.
Yes, I think we both are.
And I think part of that is that like when crises happen, it's like, oh, my brain is planned for this. I have been in 1,000 bike accidents I've never been in, right? In just the nature of my worries and stuff. and how I confront problems. So that's a really good point, actually.
But I do actually think, and to be fair, even though I've heard this 15 times, and by the 15th time, I was still excited, but also growing a little bit wary, is I do think ketones are having some impact. And I had to make sure, I was like, David, how many bottles of ketones are you taking a day?
I did take three one day. Yeah,
did you take three? You told me two.
Man, I'm trying to heal. I don't remember. I was repeating myself with ketones.
Okay, but the basic premise is, and I think when you break down kind of what you just said in the article, I actually find it really fascinating, is that when you have a traumatic brain injury, there's like a transient increase in glucose as like, so like the brain is utilizing more glucose in that like initial phase.
Yeah.
And then as the brain goes on to recover, there's actually a prolonged decrease in glucose metabolism.
Interesting. Yeah.
And that's where the theory is that ketones come in. What I think though is super wild is that there's only been one study that has looked at sex differences in ketones and how that might impact TBI recovery. And they are finding some differences in how females, like especially their plasma levels of beta hydroxybutyrate, which is a ketone byproduct, like how females might respond to ketone esters versus males.
More.
So females have a lower level of beta hydroxybutyrate in the plasma at baseline.
Yeah.
But then when they take ketones, it increases like up by over 500% compared to 100% in males.
Yeah.
And so they're starting to question whether like ketones could be like neuroprotective or neurotoxic in females. And so it's kind of interesting how there are those like sex and gender differences in how ketones, and you might even think about how that's like physiologically relevant
for the athletes,
for like post-exercise ketones.
Yeah, we're starting to learn so much more about this. We actually got sent in by a listener who works in this field, a new study that just came out on ketones being used for heart failure treatment. Very fascinating stuff there and showing improved responses there. I think basically because it's harnessing evolutionary processes, the downstream impacts seem kind of uncertain, and there could be negative ones associated with it. But more and more, we're saying two or three times per week post-exercise is a okay place to start if you're feeling anything that might respond to this. And you know where a great place to get that is?
Where?
The feed.
Oh, we love the feed.
This wasn't supposed to be our promo, but I want to throw it in because if you want, what we use is just like HVMN Ketone IQ. There's other brands there. At thefeed.com/swap, S-W-A-P, you can get an $80 free credit to try this type of thing where you can basically get it for free if you use the $80 credit. And it's not a miracle thing, but more and more in athletes, I actually saw someone's blood work today that started using them 8 weeks ago. And the blood numbers as it relates to red blood cells improved while the stress levels decreased. So type of thing where it's purely anecdotal and theoretical at this point, but maybe worth a try if you feel like you're a little bit on that recovery edge.
Well, I'm always going to be like the background skeptic.
Yeah.
You're going to be like the lead singer and I'm like the background that's like skeptic.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think like the feed, the people there are so amazing. Like the way that they've supported you. Corinne at the feed, she's been a longtime friend and athlete that we've worked with. Corinne Chavoy at the feed sent you the nicest care package of all time. And the feed, like everyone that we've interacted with at the feed, so, so nice. And it's gotten to the point where I just like, I want to support a company that has those values and has the carbs.
And they sent this hugely valuable recovery kit that is coming today where, I mean, it's just wild how well they treat people. And they do this for everybody, not just people that they're partnered with.
Not just people who get plowed by a Subaru.
You do not have to get hit by an 89-year-old.
Actually, you know the perks of being 89?
What?
I think she was probably, it sounds like, and based off of the accident, I think she was driving really slow.
Yeah, I do think so. Based on my memories. What I think of is kind of like pool, right? Where I was a really fast moving ball.
Yeah.
And then she was a very slow moving ball.
Yeah.
And my ball was moving fast enough that it just launched me when I got deflected slightly. So you don't need to do that to get the benefits from the feed. So thefeed.com/swap, S-W-A-P. Okay, let's go on to other stuff. Let's not talk about that anymore. Main thing I want to say, your training through all of this has been incredible. We are now under 3 weeks out from the Canyons 100K Mega. You had probably your best training week ever in terms of actual physiological response. Hell yeah.
Yeah, it was a big training week, partially because you got me a 50-mile ride right into the trauma unit. But then—
That's what good coaches do.
I know. I went on and had, I mean, I don't know. It was a very weird place to be because I was in this emotional state and it was like, I mean, just processing all of this has been a lot. Like we haven't really been sleeping. Like there's just a lot that's been going on.
I've been sleeping.
Yeah. I have not been sleeping. Well, Leo's had a cough. Like there's been a lot going on. And to be able to stack this training week in the context of all of this, I was like, what is happening right now? But it is one of those reflections of running is just a great place to process things.
Yeah.
And I felt so alive out there on some of those runs, just like, you know, feeling it all and processing it and somehow strung together a good training week.
So the metrics I've been looking at is in your heart rate files, your heart rate after efforts, whether it's like an uphill just in the context of running or an interval, has been dropping really rapidly, which after your heart issues has not really been something I've seen. And it's a metric I track for aerobic efficiency. And it really indicates that your aerobic system is popping the fuck off right now. So it makes me very excited because, you know, Cannes 100K is one thing. But what this indicates to me is that the rest of the year is going to be bonkers, Megan. Like, you are so good now. Like, you know, we joked around 6 months ago about you getting back where you were. It's like, actually, you're better because you now have grown woman strength that is turning the dial up to fucking 14.
Well, I'm really excited. I'm excited for Canyon 100K. Actually, this has been a little bit jarring in the sense of like when you go through something like this, I'm like, Should I even race Canyon 100K? Like, you know, you're probably having a wrist surgery coming up and that just feels like a lot. But it's like, you know what? It gets back to the YOLO. Like, this is why we live life and it's why we do what we do. And so I'm actually really excited to go out there and have a day and have an adventure.
I'm going to be the best one-arm crew you've ever had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm going to do?
What?
You know how some people like chews or whatever during races? I'm going to have edible underwear.
Yeah.
Just because I can't give this to you. Megan. Eat it all.
We perform so well. But I really want to come out of it healthy so that we can have adventures like the rest of the summer together. And so, I'm really, really, really excited to race.
Maybe the car would have seen us if we were together.
Actually, I thought about that. Yeah. You know, I probably would have got trucked.
I mean,
if she didn't see you, I'm actually going to get you a bright pink Kashiya Nuyodama Canyon jersey.
That is maybe the biggest good helmet. And everybody out there, get the brightest bright jersey you've ever seen. I'm not talking like normal bright. I'm talking so bright that it disturbs people's background programming. Like, there's something in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where it's like something where you can't see things that just don't fit what you're expecting. And I want to be so out there.
You're going to be so neon.
Yeah, the brain just can't avoid it.
Yeah. Is your brain, like, speaking of that, like, I could have been riding with you.
Yeah.
Is your brain, like, I feel like there's a way, we've talked about The Midnight Library on here, which is a book that goes through like so many different iterations of life and like playing out different stories. Does your brain play out different stories of like what could have happened on the day?
God bless the broken road that led me straight to the fence. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, for sure, 100,000 times over, you know, like, but I just keep grounding myself in the gratitude of it. And, you know, when I woke up, I was dreaming about us riding together, and it's why I can't imagine what the paramedics heard with me talking about you.
Oh, they told me that you said my name like 45 times.
I was just so concerned. And I just kept saying, I love you and stuff. It distills what's important, but also points out that like, dude, I'm just fucking lucky.
Oh, you're
that
so lucky.
You weren't with me. And to me, like, it all comes back to, you know, everyone's dealing with shit. And if there's anything coaching and podcasting shows you, is that everyone is dealing with shit. And yes, there's some shit that is worse than other shit. And, you know, I don't want to sound like a victim here. But like, I do feel sad, you know, and I wish it didn't happen. But this is not a way, it's not a productive way to spend life. So whenever I have those thoughts, I just try to be like, look, I'm talking to the love of my life right now. She didn't get hit. Yeah. Like, how cool is this? And I'm so lucky. And my knees are okay. Like, you know, I think sometimes it takes going through the worst shit to realize that you're the luckiest man on earth, you know?
Oh, that's beautiful.
Kind of like Lou Gehrig when he did his last speech, when he had Lou Gehrig's disease and had to retire from the Yankees, was like, you know, today I'm the luckiest man alive, you know? And I think that sometimes you need to be jolted back to reality. And sometimes that happens at very fast speeds on a road. And unfortunately, if my dream bike didn't get hurt, I would be really happy right now.
Okay, you're going to have a dream bike. I'm making it happen. Okay. I'm like pulling all the cards. I'm like, he needs a dream bike back.
Yeah, but you're so ready for Cannes. I'm incredibly excited for this. How are you feeling approaching it?
Good. I mean, my body feels great. Like, physically, I do feel. And I think actually what you're describing in terms of like the heart rate response is, I think I've learned two fundamental things in this training block. And I think this is relevant for all athletes, but especially relevant for my physiology, is the first 2 to 3 miles of a run really matter.
Interesting. Yeah.
And they set the tone for the rest of the run and the rest of the workout. And I think my inclination is always just, I like party raging, like maybe going out the door a little too fast.
And especially when you feel good at the start.
Yeah. And now it's like, I'm really focusing on just like low heart rate first 2 to 3 miles, especially on long runs. And it's kind of wild how that sets the tone for like heart rate recovery and like how my runs trend the rest of the time. And then the second point is efficiency. So before some of my long runs and before thinking about event like Canyons, you're telling me to go out the door and just run efficiently. And it's been really helpful to kind of channel that as I like run uphill and downhill is like, what's the most efficient form? What's the most efficient type of effort? Yeah. And it's just been like a new format to work into. And I really like it.
Yeah. you know what the most efficient way to get to the fence is?
What?
Get hit by an 89-year-old woman.
You would have got there more efficiently if you got hit by the truck on last week's episode.
True. Maybe it was the ghost of that truck.
I know. Well, I thought about that. I was like, I gave the truck the finger behind its back. Did I cause karma in the universe that caused this to happen?
Karma that made me not die.
Yeah. Well, my reflection though is I really want to go and give that 89-year-old a hug. Yeah. Like, I want you to call her and just to, like, I don't know, tell her she's loved. But if it had been the pickup truck that did that,
oh yeah,
I would have gone and strangled that guy's intestines. Then I would have given him a hug. I probably would have reached empathy like 24 hours later.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So you would have first strangled him with his own large intestine, and then you would have hugged him while he was dangling from the roof.
Still a hug.
Still a hug. Okay. So let's move on to a really interesting new article from Velo, which is by a podcast listener. So really exciting whenever that happens. And it's on extreme fueling in the Pro Peloton, the topic we talk about a lot on here.
And it's so fun to think about extreme fueling and also even how extreme fueling might lead to like recovery in a situation like yours or performance adaptation. And it has taken off in the Pro Peloton to the point where they are stickerizing it.
Yes. And so what this article did is it examined the stickers that are on the head tube of these bikes. So essentially stickers are used as little cheat codes where you know exactly what you need to take when you need to take it. And so like deciphering old hieroglyphics, the article went through and determined how much athletes were actually consuming. And what they found is in these one-day classic races, which are more intense than a stage race, let's say, where it's pretty much hard the whole time, athletes are trying to consume between 100 and 120 grams of carbs per hour. And it overlaps with what we said before. Like at the top end of sport, this is ubiquitous now. It is why everything's getting faster. Like what was really interesting this year that I thought was that at Paris-Roubaix, the big bike race that happened this weekend, not only was it the fastest time in history, and yes, there's a little tailwind, but this race has been run forever. They've had tailwinds before. The 26th fastest time was faster than the fastest time in history. The last place rider went faster than the fastest rider back in 2012.
That's wild. Yeah, those are some wild stats.
Everything is going crazy. And that, you know.
And I feel like we're seeing parallels to that in running.
Definitely.
Yes. And it's not just because, like, I mean, we are having, I think, in both cycling and running, an influx of people who want to do the sport. And so, like, our denominator is bigger. So you expect that, like, these performances are going to get better. But I don't think that explains it all.
Especially in cycling.
Yes.
Because in cycling, they've always had this pipeline of elite performers that are killing themselves to see which are the eggs that don't break when you throw them against the wall. Yes, ultra running is subject to a little bit. More of the denominator bias, but cycling, that is top end, choosing the best of the best figure out what is the good thing to do. And I mean, even we're participating in it. Like, yes, at Crown King Scramble, your time is not unexpected based on your history, but me beating the types of people I beat historically, that is a fueling byproduct. Like, it's the only thing that's possible because I know my level and yes, I'm incredibly good, you know, relatively, and I'm very fortunate for that, but I'm not at the level of some of the people whose times in the past I beat out there. And I think it's because I'm really good at slurping.
Yeah. Well, I would love to see a slurping study that's looking at cyclists versus ultra runners. Because I do think like some ultra runners are able to get in 100 to 120. But I think the much more common scenario is like 75 to 90 grams of carbs per hour, accounting for the fact that like running has a much more of a GI, like a stomach jostling effect.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious between the two of those. But what I noticed was on the sticker, so I went through like each sticker. Yeah. It was really fun. And I was trying to do this deciphering and then seeing what the article concluded and seeing if we had like similar like hypotheses. Some of the stickers were done by time. So like at 20 minutes in, take this, 45 minutes in, take this. Others were done by distance. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, classically as a coach, I often think about time. I always think about time-based fueling.
Yeah.
And what do you think, like, for me, there's like some obvious pros and cons that stand out between the two of those, but how do you structure it as a coach?
I think you generally know how those overlap, right? Like the cyclists, the reason they go by distance is they know the exact correlations of times within a few minutes.
It's so close. And I think it's much closer to me than ultra running. Like I feel like in ultra running, sometimes like, you know, the error bars on the time differences
especially
are
later on.
Much larger.
Yeah, yes. I think you have to go by time. I think it's the only way to keep yourself accountable too. Like tons of people have messaged recently saying, I want to do this, but I can't. And because whenever I take in a gel, I reject it and stuff. And it's like, that's why we partnered with the feed. So thefeed.com/swap, because the new types of fuel sources make it so that you can bypass the taste buds if you have to. So like a good example, when I take a Science and Sport beta fuel gel, which is what I was taking at Crown King for the most part, though I did take a bunch of precisions. For me, what I mean by slurping is that I can just squirt it past my tongue to where I'm taking it like a shot.
Okay, but you're like skilled. You have levels of excellence in that are far exceed normal capabilities. Like whenever I try to do that mechanism, my tongue gets involved. My tongue can't stay out of the drama.
Your tongue is like a Kardashian. It's just like, I need to be in this picture. We got a reality show to film. I mean, the thing is, though, you don't struggle with consuming.
That's true.
You've never had those issues. Yeah. Like, you can consume.
I can consume all day long.
Yeah, exactly. The tongue don't quit. Yeah, I know. That tongue believes it can fly. But no, for me, like, that's been game changing. Like, I could never do this with old school stuff. So as a reminder, make sure you're doing this. We get so many messages. We're saying like 10 a week of people talking about their new PR, their new breakthrough, and tying it mostly to, quote, food doping. I just think it's so important. And sometimes we actually get a little bit of flack for talking about this so much. And I'm like, well, it's because it's the one thing that literally every listener needs to do to understand where their limits are.
No, I love that. And I think it is like, when you boil it down, it's like, I stand firm on that. There's some things when people push back, I'm like, I can have some wiggle room on this. On this, I'm like, I believe
there's zero exceptions.
Yeah.
Zero physiologicals. If someone says they're an exception, it's because they haven't actually done the work to see what their physiology is capable of.
That's an amazing point. I love that.
You know, even includes elite athletes, people that are elite in ultras who think that this isn't the thing for them. It's like, yeah, it's because we're not in cycling. You know, in ultras, ultra running, it gets back to our points, like there is less of the selection pressure. So you can sometimes get people that are very, very successful at the top end who are not doing things that they need to do to optimize themselves, but they're so good that it doesn't matter. And then a lot of the times those non-optimal things become the subjects of podcasts and articles and things. Like, look at what this person's doing. It's like, no, show me cycling, where there is so much selection pressure at the top end that anything that implicates the very, very top pointy end will be, become widely used. It's why doping was such a big problem in cycling. It's like, well, if we're in this high selection pressure event and people are doing something that is evil and cheating, then of course that little bit of a percent will make a difference. And so, now what a lot of the people that watch the sport say is it's not cheating anymore. It's doing something that's perfectly legal and we can all do.
Okay. Well, high five very carefully for selection pressure. We'll give that.
Was that count?
Yeah.
Well, that's more of like ecology.
Well, point. I've never heard that before. And I really like how you phrase that. I thought
Megan,
it was excellent.
Oh, Megan, I took a number of ecology classes. Yeah. In college, I would, every weekend, they would like take us to the Pine Barrens, which was the ultimate, from New York City to the Pine Barrens or whatever, some random forest. Yeah. And then we would measure the trees. We would measure all the biomass in it. It was really cool.
That sounds so much cooler than like the science that I did.
I know.
I wish I didn't know much about environmental science when I was in college. Yeah. And if I did, I totally would have been like, take me to the trees.
Well, it's so cool. Predisposition to that subject. Like, it's not like we didn't do that in high school or anything. But when I got to New York City and you're surrounded by so much jungle, I need to escape, at least in my mind. So I immediately went to environment and astronomy. I almost said astrology. Environment and astronomy, because both let me escape the city. And then eventually I found like my calling in that world via that.
That's so cool. While you were digging around in trees, I was digging around in bodily organs. And now I would like to go back to the trees.
Yeah, last night I was like, what did you see in the emergency room when you were doing rotation?
I know, you've asked me so many questions about like my trauma. You're very fascinated in it now.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. When you're going through it, you're like, that sounds like a terrible job. And maybe final reflection for me on everything is like, thanks so much to the first responders out there. Like, probably 25 or 30 people responded to this accident. And like, I felt nothing but love the whole time. And it's kind of like when my mom was in a coma, we tried to reprogram her brain with love as much as we could. And I feel like something might have happened to me where those paramedics, those firefighters, those police people, like, they gave me some sort of like positive mental energy that has taken me through the recovery process so far.
And then when we got to the hospital too, and the nurses, our nurses were amazing.
So cool.
Matthew was there and we really bonded with him. And I feel like
we told him about the podcast.
We just, yeah, I know.
I should have given out business cards to the paramedics. Like, Somewhere Call Play Podcast. Huzzah.
Well, you just need a chest tattoo that says Somewhere Call Play Podcast then a QR code.
So when they cut off my clothes.
Exactly. It's right there.
They're like, QR code.
We're just going to scan them.
Boom.
Enough with the Road ID bracelets. You just need a QR code on your chest.
Love it. Okay, let's go on to some shoe reviews. Before that, make sure you give the podcast 5 stars and click follow wherever you listen. It helps other people find it. We love this community so much. The outpouring of love and support has been so cool. And if you want to do something for us, it just takes 20 seconds to do that. Give it 5 stars and click follow.
It means the world. And check out our Patreon too. So you wanted to record. So the accident happened on Thursday. You wanted to record a Patreon on Friday.
Yeah.
And when I told you no, you're like, I'm going to march upstairs and do it solo.
I would have too, if it weren't for your stupid meddling, like the Scooby-Doo when they catch the guy. I love Patreon so much. And for me, it's like therapeutic thing. Like I was able to respond to questions after the accident when I woke up at 2 a.m. unable to sleep because of the pain. And it grounded me in a way that was so meaningful. So patreon.com/swap, S-W-A-P. We actually did a full breakdown of low energy availability as the article last week. And we're talking 6,000 words digging into why we talk about it the way we do. This isn't fueling during exercise as much as it's fueling outside of exercise, where the nuance comes in and where it doesn't. So check that out if you really want to deep dive into our brains.
Are you going to dictate your writing articles going forward? It does put you, it's been really fun actually to hear your brain processes as you dictate. And do you think that's going to be a staple going forward?
I think so. Yeah. I think dictation is actually a huge takeaway from all this, is that if you get an app that you just plug into Chrome or something, it allows you to process ideas more rapidly than through typing. And I think maybe it's because of the podcast, but I feel pretty comfortable doing that verbally. And it's a good way to start. And so instead of outlining, dictate and then go from there. And I mean, I've heard of authors that dictate before, and now it makes a lot more sense because the tech is so good. It all utilizes AI. So it learns my voice and brain over time. And so I'm pretty in love with it, as you can imagine when I mentioned AI.
Which is so cool. I wonder if it's learned my background snark levels. So the AI, like the dictation is really good. And so I'm often in the room with you and just like telling you random things, and it's picking it up and putting it in whatever communication. And it's actually kind of a risk because I've realized just how many snarky comments I make, because you're like, Megan, I got to delete all that.
No one would cancel us for you being funny as hell. No one in the world would do that.
But I am curious about whether podcasting, like, I dictated in med school and I don't think I was particularly good at it, like dictated like patient notes, but I wonder if podcasting has changed that. I should go back and try to dictate.
It's really good. I think it teaches you a lot about speaking and how some of my words are very hard to understand, even for AI. Okay, let's go on to shoe reviews. So the other week we went to Fleet Feet here in Boulder. It used to be called Boulder Running Company. It is the number one place we go whenever we need anything. Like basically we try not to buy online. Whenever they have anything in stock, we go there just to support the local store.
Yeah, support your local shoe stores. It's also so fun to go there because they just have like walls and walls of shoes.
Yeah.
And to both of us, it's like endless possibilities. And they're always so nice. And we spend a lot of time in there trying on a number of different shoe models.
So they reached out and gave us a credit so that we could go in and get shoes. They said we didn't even have to talk about going there. So we got these shoes for free, which is always very cool. And not only that, we got to work with the awesome employee, Rachel. And I don't know, for me, shoe stores, that is how to get my brain back to 100%.
Like, we should take you there tonight.
They ignite my soul. Yeah. It's so good. So we got to try out some shoes that we want to talk about real quick. The first is a general category of super trainers. I think this is really a new thing in running shoes. And I think it's the arrow that most athletes should have in their quiver, is a shoe that isn't a super shoe. So we're not talking one of those shoes that wears out real quick and like the Nike Vaporfly or Alphafly. We're talking a shoe that's the next level down, where it has some sort of stabilization plate, whether that's a nylon plate, even light carbon plates in some of these shoes, and then a softer foam. And what I found personally is that my love affair with the Hoka Mach X, which is a super trainer, has made my easy running so much more pleasurable and also helped my zone 2 running in a way we're going to get to in just a second. And so I think super trainers are the number one like little thing to help with your training process. And you can put tons of miles in these. Like I put 400 miles in my Mach X. It's just like any other shoe. So the cost benefit analysis is really good on these.
And to me, it's actually curious from like a business perspective, how it's made shoe companies evolve their product lines.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like you can see their train of thought in shoes. It's like you have like your chonky trainer, like your everyday type of trainer, like for Hoka, it could be the Clifton. For Saucony, it could be the Kinvara, which is significantly less chonky than the Clifton.
Or the Triumph.
Or the Triumph. Right. Yeah, actually, I love the Saucony Triumph. And then you have the performance trainer, and then you have a super shoe. And I love how like for the models, like for me, I got the Kinvara Pro as the performance trainer and I love it. But what I love is that it feels very similar to the Triumph, which is like the regular trainer I'm already wearing. And it's kind of nice to have this like consistent iteration across shoe lines.
Yeah. My big thing is I think these super trainers, they last just as long. There's, you know, really good evidence that they make you faster, not such good evidence on like injury rates and stuff like that. But for me, it helps my running form feel better. So a good example is your run, the first one that you did in the Kinvara Pro, the Saucony Kinvara Pro, a shoe you wouldn't have got probably unless you got a free credit, because you just, it's like a risk. You don't know what you're getting with this. And I turn around, we had started at similar times. I started just before, and you were catching me on an easy run, which is something that hasn't happened since like 2016.
When I was doing quote easy runs that were like easy mod runs.
You were sprinting.
Yes.
Yeah. And I turn around, I'm like, what the fuck is happening? And you come back and your heart rate to pace ratio was the best it's ever been at altitude. I mean, you were running under a 7 minute pace at low heart rates. And it points out like the value of these shoes. It's something about them. It's not just the energy return. It's about how it encourages this type of efficiency we've talked about.
And I think also on that line too, recovery. Like we've talked about the concept of like recovery with like, you know, with
super shoes,
carbon plated super shoes. But I do think there's also something to like performance trainers and how that impacts recovery. Like I did that run and I felt great. Like it didn't feel like it actually took that much out of my legs or my body. And I do think that has something to do with the nylon plate. But I would love to see a study actually looking at like injury rates as well as like biomechanical patterns patterns in a shoe with a nylon plate compared to a carbon plate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's
do you have any hypotheses on that?
I think probably the nylon plate has lower injury risk because it has less return.
Yeah, exactly. So like, yes.
You know, the carbon plate, slower. Yeah. And the carbon plate is just so much stiffness that stiffness leads to speed, right? Like even when they measure individual athlete stiffness through like the plantar, that like more stiffness is better running economy usually. Similarly, these shoes add stiffness to that area of the foot. So clearly there's going to be a little bit more pressure on that area. I think a nylon plate or a PIBA plate or something like that would be a little bit better probably from an injury rate perspective. But in general, I just think these super trainers, I think the in 20 years, the everyday Brooks Glycerin or whatever is going to be fully out of style unless an athlete is not going for, you know, their top performance. I think we're going to move to a world of super trainers because they last just as long. Yeah, they're a little more expensive, but I think that's mainly because shoe companies can charge a little bit more for them and it's worth it at the end of the day.
Do you set constraints? So typically I tell athletes like 2 days a week, maybe 3 days a week max in carbon plated shoes, just because there is more of that energy return. Do you give like stipulations or guidelines for nylon plated shoes? Like how would you rank that? No, and I don't either. Yes.
Like I wear the Mach X for everything now.
Yeah.
I wear it for my race. I don't feel any higher injury risk from it.
You wear them to walk out of the trauma unit. Actually, you walked out in socks, actually.
The hospital socks.
Actually, it was kind of wild. You walked out like carrying this bike that was totally jacked up in your face. Like, a lot of people have been looking at you. They've been giving you looks as you walked out of there.
Good Halloween costume, though.
That's true. That's fair. Yeah. I know. You were a, what were you one year? You were Tour de Francia?
Yeah, Tour de Francia.
With a Francia like wine box. Uh-huh. And we could recreate that.
A dead Tour de Francia. A sexy dead Tour de Francia.
A zombie Tour de Francia. Perfect for Halloween.
Perfect. A zombie that wants to fuck. Okay, and then what I got, you can tell a pattern here, is I got the super shoe, the Adidas Adizero Pro 3. And it feels so good to me. You can tell we got more expensive shoes because it's like, hey, we're going to get these for free. We're not going to get cheap ones. And it was one of the best workouts of my life on Wednesday when I wore them for the first time, just for the speed part. And I loved it so much that it felt just like the original Alphafly 1. So the subsequent versions of the Nike Alphafly, the 2 and 3, I haven't worn the 3, but the 2 was horrid for me. It just didn't work. And the 1 was this shoe magic that I haven't been able to reclaim. And
can you find the 1 online?
I haven't been able to. I think these other people have the same thought.
Yes, yeah.
And this shoe, the Adidas Adizero Pro 3, was awesome. I loved it. And it also makes me think I need to experiment a lot more with Adidas shoes in general. So they just came out with a trail super shoe, the Agravec Speed Ultra. We haven't gotten our hands on it, but that might check a lot of the boxes I've been looking for of a trail shoe that isn't such a brick. So a lot of fun things to come. I think basically shoe companies are innovating so fast here that the entire field is going to change every year.
And I think the innovations, as we've talked about, are getting more and more in the trail lines in particular. Like in the road line, like there's been a ton of innovation, but the room is much larger to innovate in the trail line. And I really want to try those Adidas super shoes, the Agravecs.
So hey, Adidas, you listening, send us a shoe. We'll talk about it.
Send us the Ultrafly 2 too from Nike.
Oh yeah.
I've heard the from what I've heard from athletes, like the stack height, what I love about the Ultrafly 1 actually is I have felt so good technical running in them. And I think it's because the stack height's a little bit lower. And I'm really worried they're going to mess that up in the Ultrafly 2.
Yeah. Well, I tried on some trail shoes when we were at the store and we're not going to name any names. But what the fuck is up with trail shoes? They're so bad.
But you can name a name.
No.
Is it a smaller shoe company?
Yeah. But I mean, every shoe company has the same, it's like the same type of shoe. It's like, let's put this really, really firm foam that makes no sense biomechanically. Like every single one of the foams that measures the best in lab tests is a little softer with a little bit of stabilization inside of it. So let's take this really firm foam, put it with these massive claws and see how you like it. It's like, of course trail runners are going to think shoes suck. It's like, if you made any of these super trainers that we're talking about, just put some lugs on them, give them a little bit of stability, we'd be talking about the best trail shoe on the market.
Yeah. I also want my trail shoe to feel relatively reasonable on road. And I feel like the Ultraflies for me cross that.
A great comparison is the Endorphin Pro, the Kinvara Pro that you've been wearing, super trainer.
Oh, I love it.
Versus the Endorphin Edge, Saucony's more super trail shoe.
Oh my God, it's so built up, the super trail shoe.
It's just like, you wear it and it's like, okay, this isn't for me. It's just very clear right off the bat. It's just not, it's not it. And
what about it is not it for you? Nate, get specific.
Okay. So you put it underfoot. One, it's a little bit flexible in a way that feels like questionable, but it doesn't combine that flexibility with like softness underfoot.
Yes. And it has huge talons on the bottom in terms of lugs. Like, yeah.
You get it. Saucony as a company makes some of the best shoes on the market.
Oh yeah. I'm obsessed with the Kinvara Pros, so the Triumphs, like, and the, yeah.
And I think they'll get it when it comes to, you know, trail shoes, but it's just not there yet. And I think every company has this huge opportunity. Just put your road line on trails and we'll be the happiest people on the planet.
Okay. Do you know what was a dreamy Saucony shoe though?
What?
I tried it on in SFRC, so San Francisco Running Company.
Yeah.
And I just like tried it on off the wall. I was just kind of messing around. I was like, this looks like a cool shoe. It's the Saucony Rift.
Okay.
So trail shoe, it felt very nimble and light to me. Okay. And granted, I only wore it on my left foot.
Yeah.
And now I am like lamenting. I'm like, I should have gotten those trail shoes.
Cinderella over here.
I know.
Like, where's the right Saucony Rift?
Where did it go?
Well, I need to try this too. So maybe they have solved it and I just haven't gotten my hands on them.
Yeah. So you need to get your hands on a pair of the Rifts. I really like them.
Okay.
Granted, I want them to have like a nylon plate or a carbon plate, and I don't believe they do, which is sad.
So lots more coming on that. So some NCAA basketball reflections right now.
Yeah. We can just make this our news and fun things.
Okay.
Do you want to just roll? We can, this can be the lead on our news and fun things.
And then we'll do zone two and we need some trainings.
Okay.
Okay. So first, if you have watched any of this NCAA women's tournament, it was bonkers. Everyone was bringing it. Like South Carolina ended up winning and had an undefeated season, but Caitlin Clark captured the country's imagination. The ratings on the championship were almost 20 million people watching it. The most watched basketball game of any type in the last 6 years. Most watched basketball game on ESPN ever. Insane.
It was so wild to watch it. And I feel like we were kind of in a sleep deficit heading into your accident because we were just staying up well past our bedtime being like, we want to watch Caitlin Clark and Paige Beckers and South Carolina.
And Juju Watkins.
Yeah, it was like, I think for me is there's like so many individual players right now in women's basketball that capture the athletic imagination and do so while paralleling like big personality in different ways. Like there's so many different big personalities in women's basketball.
Oh, and I love it. I love Angel Reese on LSU so much.
Oh my gosh. She's amazing. And I feel like seeing them come together and also like how they battle each other with big personalities. I love it.
But it points out that, you know, this whole time there have been,
oh, it's been there,
incredible athletes in women's basketball and in women's sports in general. It's just because of, I think, Caitlin Clark, there was a media focus on it that allowed the other personalities to also shine. And the point is, you know, Caitlin Clark is doing incredible things because she has opened up this area of like attention. But the things that we are now looking at were there all along. And we're as guilty as anybody because like, yeah, we would watch the NCAA tournament, but we wouldn't follow college basketball year round for women. And now it's like we watched maybe 100 women's games and maybe one men's game. We tried to watch one Duke game, our alma mater, and we're just like, nope, don't like this team this year. Not for us.
I know. Yeah. The amount of time that we spent watching Caitlin Clark versus Duke was so wild. And I think it's emblematic of like women's basketball in general. And I think what my brain goes to is it's been there all along.
Yeah.
And there have been like systematic, like you look at how the NCAA has spent money to promote male basketball versus women's basketball. And like, there's been like, do you remember? It was a couple years ago where they showcased the workout rooms and the workout setups of men's basketball versus women's basketball. And the women's basketball, like workout setup was like a few dumbbells and like a bench press setup. And the men's was just like this lavish gym. And I guess my point is it's been there all along and we haven't invested in women's basketball. And so it's kind of wild to think about what's going to happen when we start fully investing in it and how it elevates like big personalities for kids who are age 5, 6, 7.
I think this is the ultimate game changing moment. And I think part of it is the tide that's sort of shifting in general with content consumption in that none of these sports games get huge ratings anymore, except the NFL. Like everything is falling pretty rapidly and football is the ultimate exception there. But as these things fall, there's no like immediate like update. Like I need to see the NBA game this day, unless you're a super fan. And into that gap, more opportunities have arisen because there isn't this like oxygen getting sucked up where like ESPN is like, well, we're not going to risk the cash cow by investing more marketing in women's sports or whatever. And now that marketing has flown a little bit and people have realized, oh, wait, this is actually potentially a greater opportunity than anything we ever had with men's sports. And it's really exciting to think how it applies across sports is that, you know, in these niches that are filling, it's like when a rainforest, when a tree goes down, it's like tons of other things are going to go up there. The trees are falling and what sprouts up is going to be women dominated. I think people love women's sports when you actually show it to them. And it's so cool to see.
Okay. You focus on ecology in college. what would you describe? So like the forest goes down. What is Caitlin Clark? Give me a plant. Give me a species. Give me something.
Well, I think she's just a new ecosystem.
Yeah. She's not even, you can't even define her to one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like an island where, a new thing takes hold, like an invasive species. And then you realize that it's actually dominant and it's going to be dominant. So, you know, invasive species are usually considered a negative thing, but it's not necessarily, like, you know, sometimes historically, like before humans, obviously human based invasive species are bad. Like those carp that just eat everything. Not a good thing. What I'm talking about is like, you know, what is like how things populate new areas over time is it's really complicated. Like this theory of spread across islands and things. But once something that is dominant reached a new island, it would just take over. And similarly, I think Caitlin Clark made it so clear right off the bat. It's like, all right, this person is a next step in the evolutionary process. And once people saw that, they're like, oh, this has actually been brewing all along. We just haven't been paying attention. And so we're counting ourselves in that group. It's like, we are all in for women's basketball now.
Where do you think this is going? And are we going to watch the WNBA? So I think historically we've watched a lot of women's college basketball, but we quite frankly haven't watched a lot of like WNBA.
Yeah.
Do you think we're going to do that?
Yeah. Because that dominant species is there, right?
I know we got to follow it.
We got to follow Caitlin.
Yeah.
So the other reflection I had is, you know, just how good Caitlin is at shooting. And all of these basketball players, when you see how good they are at shooting, you'll see stats. Like if they're just shooting open threes, they will make 90% of them in practice. You know, in games, it's obviously a lot lower percentage. But in the process, I read about one men's player who was a good shooter, but not the best shooter, who one summer essentially set this goal that every day he would have to hit 2,000 three-pointers while being guarded, and then came back as a lights-out shooter. And what's really cool to me about basketball is every single person you see out there shooting really well, it's like they have worked in ways that are so mind-numbingly boring over time that it applies so directly to running. Like, I think.
Do you think that's mind-numbingly boring, though? So I loved playing basketball, except I fouled out way too many times, so I had to switch to soccer and field hockey and some of these other sports where fouling is a little bit like easier. You can throw elbows with a little bit less referee calls. But I loved going out to the backyard and just shooting for hours. Did you not love doing that?
Yeah.
I guess when you do it like 2,000 times a day, it probably becomes more mundane.
I think you have a little bit of a personality disorder, though.
That's fair.
Oh, I say that lovingly. But
yes,
like, how did you practice field hockey? I imagine
for many hours in the same context.
And just like, that's not even a sport that's fun to practice.
You've never played. Don't knock it till you try it.
Megan, I have tried field hockey and I'm like, I understand very quickly. It's like,
well, the thing about field hockey actually is it kind of sucks when you're not good at it. And then it gets much more fun and better, like as you start improving as a field hockey player.
But the only way to improve is to practice
a ton.
This infinite number of hours.
Okay. But you know what this made me think of is I actually really like running because the parallel equivalent of going out and shooting, you know, like 2,000 shots a day, you're just going to get injured. And I think what I like about running is that like I feel like in basketball, like it takes that, but running
as you can't have a full-time job and be one of the best shooters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in running, it's like, you know, we can have a baby and, you know, an elephant with a maimed trunk right now. Yeah, yeah. And then like, I can still get in a big training week that I need for my competition. And I think that's the cool part about running is it actually does not reward relentless hard work for the sake of hard work. And it does to some extent.
Smart work.
It rewards being smart. And I think it's a really cool distinction between like running and basketball.
Such a cool reflection in relation to the cycling discussion we had.
Yeah, well, cycling does to some extent.
Oh, yeah.
Cycling, you cycle for 40 hours a week.
Yeah, 30 hours a week or whatever is pretty common, or at least 20 to 30 hours. And that's one of the reasons I actually quit that sport back when I first got into endurance sports, because for me, I can't do that. Like, it's just impossible. And knowing that my limitation would always put me at less than my best was a hard realization. Whereas in running, like 10 hours is a lot of fucking work.
Yeah.
And most people can find 10 hours if they're very creative.
And more than 10 hours, unless you're genetically gifted or proven to it over time, you're kind of playing with injury, risk, and reward.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we absolutely loved the tournament. Maybe final thing we really loved was Dawn Staley, the coach of South Carolina basketball.
I love her so much. She's actually, I think if people ask me like, who's your coaching aspiration, she's going to be my new answer.
Yeah, and what she did is in her pre-game press conference, the day before the national championship game, she got asked a question about transgender athlete inclusion. And she said, if you're a woman, you can play. That includes transgender athletes. And to me, that was such a courageous thing to do, because the easy thing to do would just be say, hey, we're focusing on the game right now. This is going to get reported by everyone. But she knew that she was being asked that question because the person was trying to be a troll, was essentially trying to put her in a place where the, you know, right-wing media apparatus would be able to jump on her and it would create this big distraction.
I think she even addressed that in her answer. And I think she said something like, I understand this is going to be used to create distraction like before the game, but I'm standing by this.
Yeah,
I thought
but
that
I'm
was
stepping
like,
into
I'm stepping into the arena. And I thought that was so cool. It also shows to me a level of swag and belief in her team that she like, she didn't need to be like, we're just focusing on the game. Like she had belief in her team to be able to step outside of that arena and be like, I'm advocating for athletes because I know my team is backed with the foundation to win this game.
And as we've talked about with coaching, with other things like the Huberman discussion last week, like you bring your full self to what you do and do not ever hesitate to bring your full self and your principles to the things that matter to you. Like, so for her to do that to me, I was, as much as we were rooting for Caitlin Clark earlier in the tournament, I wanted South Carolina to win that game. One, South Carolina is a badass team and they were historic this year. But two, Dawn Staley is my new dream coach.
Oh, she's such, I mean, also how she handled Caitlin Clark tactically
was
very impressive too. And like they deserved, like when you watched Caitlin Clark versus LSU, like LSU got trucked by Caitlin Clark just because they didn't respect her.
Yeah.
And I felt like the level of respect that Dawn Staley and UConn Geno were giving to Caitlin Clark actually like played really well into the tactics of how they competed against her.
Yeah, Dawn Staley versus Kim Mulkey. We have, there are multitudes within all coaching professions. Okay, let's go on to more news and fun things. Here's a Patreon question. As always, patreon.com/swap, S-W-A-P. I hope you are all keeping well. Thanks for all the brilliant insight you and Megan deliver every week on the podcast. I'm a longtime listener who looks forward to the insights, but also the warmth and joy that you both emanate. It's much needed these days. I do have a question, which I would be grateful if you could help me with. You often talk about, quote, growing our sport and the benefits of big corporations, e.g. shoe companies, and even UTMB, if they behave, promoting and growing the sport. My question is, who does growing the sport benefit, and why would we want that to happen? Sounds like a dumb question, eh? Personally, speaking as an old, slow, but passionate ultra runner, I like that trail/ultra running is under the radar. Trails aren't generally crowded, and it's not usually a massive event. No fanfare. Money corrupts and ruins every sport it touches. Do you have any thoughts on this, please?
This is a great question. And I feel like it actually feeds in really well coming off the discussion of like NCAA women's basketball and kind of like the growing fanfare and support around that. And I think to me, this gets back to the idea. It's like the 5, 6, 7 year olds, like, you know, girl athletes that are seeing Caitlin Clark and some of these other like, you know, Juju Watkins.
And Caitlin Clark saw Maya Moore.
Yeah, exactly.
Back in the day, that was her idol when she was in elementary school.
Yeah. And I think for me, the growth of trail running is about the people it spreads to down the line, whether that's youth or whether it's people that have like, don't even know what a trail is or even have access to trails, like in their immediate like city access. And so I think like growing the sport to me is about like the gift of access and the gift of giving something that like people don't even know about as a way of like freedom of exploration.
And also ties back to Dawn Staley because exclusivity benefits the in-group, the people that are in the group. And whenever inclusivity—
Actually, questionably though— Because I think like...
Well, it benefits them in their own minds.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm...
And maybe maybe even from like a limited resource, like like sociological framework perspective, but I don't think from like a mental, like how you process the world perspective.
I mean, diversity and inclusion is always a good thing. Yeah. Obviously, that's the place we're coming from. But where do some of these feelings come from? It's because we all have that evolutionary programming within us to say, why add one more person to our tribe when we only get this much resource to begin with? We all have that implication. But the point here is that we are not actually resource limited, and that when you can build up visibility and build up the denominator, build up availability, everyone else gets to experience these incredible things. And then it just builds the pool of resources that are potentially available in the future. So for us, it's about right now, trail running is growing and ultra running is growing, but it has been so magical to our journeys. Like when I woke up and I knew my legs would be okay to run eventually, I was just so happy because this sport has given so much to my life and so much meaning to me. And if we can give that to other people, that would be awesome. But the only way to do that is by, you know, singing the praises, increasing availability, putting it on, you know, coverage, having UTMB be successful, having these shoe companies grow and see their investment works. Like all of that stuff, all those cold, hard capitalist economics build into this communal feeling that this sport will grow and help the millions of people who have not discovered it yet.
And how do you combat? Because yes, like I feel like whenever there is an influx of money, to be fair, there are cons that come in. Like yes, trails become more crowded, events become harder to get into. Like, you know, there are like minor and sometimes major inconveniences that come with that influx of money and support. How would you tell someone to like handle that or process that? Because like it is not just like fully a pro situation, but I think the pros like vastly outweigh the cons.
That more opportunity arises as well.
Yes. Yeah.
Nothing, there will never be constraint for long. And, you know, yes, I'm mixing economic models here, but, you know, the good thing about capitalist approaches to the world is that when there is this more money, there are more resources, there will be more opportunity for everyone, for race directors, for trail builders.
There'll be new races that build. There'll be new trails that get constructed.
Coaches, podcasts, all of this. The reason we say start a podcast is like, right now, start it because there's going to be 1,000 more in, you know, a few years. And that's a good thing. Like the more opportunity there is, the better. And so let's increase the visibility, increase the opportunity, and I think it'll be good for everybody.
I love that.
Okay. On to the next thing. This is a Zone 2 comment. So Matt McElroy, a pro triathlete, tweeted this, and I was very intrigued. Rule number 72. I guess they have a bunch of rules. It's like a thing they do about training.
Well, isn't that, it's the playoff of, is it dodgeball?
I think Wedding Crashers, maybe.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, wrong 90s movie.
So it's just like random rules.
Actually, that was the aughts, right?
Aughts, yes.
Yeah, fuck.
Dude, good job, though.
Why?
You spotted when it was. You like carbon dated Wedding Crashers in your head. Very impressed by you. You're very smart. Okay, it was rule number 72. If you want to get fit for cheap, run 6-minute mile pace for all of your runs.
It's an interesting point. I also think it's curious too that he's a triathlete.
Yeah.
And I feel like this actually parallels a lot of general triathlon training, is that they're like by necessity running less because they're doing, they're swimming and running, or they're swimming and biking and doing these other sports, that like running has to be like a smaller slice of the pie than if it was the full pie alone.
Yeah.
And I feel like in that case, there is a lot of bang for the buck in terms of like, for him, like 6-minute pace is probably like Z2 in a 5-zone model.
Yeah. And I think that's the complicated thing that I wanted to point out here, is that a lot of the times in training theory, you'll see these stories of elite athletes running pretty fast almost all the time, especially on their easy days. And I think the place that's missed is that some people read that and are like, oh, he's saying run 6-minute pace. So he's saying run moderate all the time. Similarly, Harvard's program is notorious for this. They're like, they run 6-minute pace all the time or faster. But the point is that the athletes that can sustain it, like the guy that won the
Graham Blanks,
and they're so economical that for them, these paces are not actually that fast. It's like a normal person running 10 or 12 minute pace.
Well, it's like for you, when you went out for your first run after like after having your crash.
So spoiler alert, I have gone for runs in my sling and some number of people rode in.
Well, and they were sub 7-minute pace. But like, if you look at those heart rates on your runs, like it's actually like, you're probably
zone one.
Yeah. And you're just so economical.
But I think sometimes we get so caught up in paces that we lose the effort point.
Yes.
And so the point he's saying is that, look, once you build up, a lot of zone two is helpful in a 5-zone model. And I think that point does apply to everybody. It's just that zone two is only very fast for freaks like Matt. And so remember that, like, as you're deriving training theory from this, it's to say, it's okay to run a little bit faster on my easy days. That's a good thing. But make sure you're not going too hard with heart rate, essentially. Make sure you're not going into zone three. So my response to this tweet was a great rule to think about. The way I like to apply this idea for advanced athletes, and as a reminder, advanced just means you've been doing it for a few years, not you're necessarily advanced in terms of genetic talent, is one, develop your running economy. That means aerobic base, strides, and general strength. That is always the core of swap work. Number two, make sure you're injury resistant, focusing on fueling, PT, and your personal history. You don't want to do this if you get stress fractures. Number three, run a lot of your easy mile in zone two in a 5-zone model. So zone two is magic. That is true. But zone two for most people is just very, very easy.
I love that breakdown. Did you actually tweet this?
I did.
Oh, wow. Look at you. Well, because, I'm not on Twitter these days, so I don't actually know.
I don't tweet much. This is like one tweet in like 5 weeks. But
I know. I'm like, you must really believe in this.
I like Matt McElroy a lot.
Yes.
And we respect each other. And so I liked what he said. I think it's a really good training point. But I think sometimes people miss the nuance to say, like, what he's saying is just when athletes get advanced, they still need to do Z2.
Yes.
And I think sometimes athletes, when they get super advanced, they learn too much of their past lessons. Like at the start of running careers, everyone goes too hard. And then once people get really advanced, they're like, every easy run should be so easy, like ridiculously easy. And like, while we think maybe half of your easy running should be ridiculously easy and you need to monitor recovery, some of your easy running should still be going back to that well of what you learned when you were young to really get the mitochondrial stress to improve long-term. And you know, this especially applies to athletes that are a little bit more volume limited.
Actually, I was just about to say that it gets back to the point of the idea that like we've had athletes in general doing a little bit more cross training for athletes that are like injury prone or like, you know, just have not been able to get in that volume.
Yeah.
And I think that's a place where like a higher proportion of Z2 compared to Z1 for easy running matters, is as long as like, you know, you're not pushing up against like the injury well.
Yeah. And that's where uphill treadmill comes in. Very easy to get into Z2 with no pounding, cross training, quality short doubles, things like that. And one little thing I wanted to throw in that shows some of the physiological basis for this sort of thing is a 1992 study. This is really, really quick, but it's one of the classics. This is much like, you know, Gone with the Wind. Or like
1992.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, I'm glad that we're bringing, I was age two back then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Subaru driver, I guess, was 57.
1992, 35. Right? Actually, I think older, right? 30. Oh, no. Math is not good on the fly. You're also, right. 57 is right.
Also, you're concussed. I'm like, yeah. You better not beat me in this math game right now. That would be really embarrassing.
I gained IQ points. Okay. So one of the classics, I love this one. And it looked at the percentage of type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers, so slow twitch and intermediate or fast twitch muscle fibers, was determined by biopsies. And then they measured their economy at 52% and 71% of VO2 max. They charted work rate against caloric expenditure, classic economy example. And basically they found that slow twitch muscle fibers were so much more efficient at generating work for energy use with R values of 0.85 and 0.75. So pretty damn high.
Those are very strong, like correlational R values for context. And so I guess the hard part here is that like type 1 versus type 2 muscle fiber typology is often like genetically determined. And then you can kind of like steer that in the direction of like how you train or how you structure things. Yeah. And a lot of that even comes from like how you're training as an adolescent and then like into like your young adult years.
Yeah.
How do you use that concept of like, okay, so like type 1 muscle fiber is more economical. How do you use that to structure training and training theory?
I think this is the most important thing, honestly, in long-term growth. And I always love the twin study that we've talked about a lot before, that if you take a sedentary twin versus an active twin that were separated at birth, the active twin had 55% more type 1 slow twitch fibers from training itself, which is totally contrary to what would be predicted from the genetic models. So clearly there's an ability to push these numbers. You just don't measure it on these types of long time horizons in practice. And you have to think about what recruits different types of muscle fibers in training. So the reason this is relevant is Z2 is the best way to recruit those type 1 muscle fibers that are most efficient. It is really your friend. That means a lot of easy training. It can also be Z1, but the more easy training, the better. Number two, avoid excessive anaerobic work. The reason we love strides is it's short, but it's not purely anaerobic because it's under 30 seconds. So keep the really, really hard stuff under 30 seconds. And then some of the longer stuff, just make sure you're not racing your intervals essentially.
And I think then another point on top of that too, is like thinking about your lifting strategy. So yeah. I think like we've been recently expanding out how we like prioritize and focus on strength training, which is like heavier lifting, like really thinking about like squats and deadlifts and things like that. But I think not trying to lift for the sake of hypertrophy or for the sake of like getting better at lifting, but rather to support training. And then in that process, you're avoiding like recruiting type 2 muscle fibers.
Yeah. I think it's the main thing that might be missed in some of the lifting theory is that people assume when they look at runner lifting that they're starting from the pure slow twitch athlete. And the point is no, actually, if you take an athlete like me who played football, which is most people are somewhere on the intermediate range, if you take them and you throw heavy types of lifting to failure at them, they will get less efficient because they'll be preferentially recruiting the wrong muscle fibers. So do pay attention to this. Understand that a lot of our training theory stuff and our fueling stuff, it all comes back to what type of muscle fibers are you recruiting. And then to remember, the best thing of all is that you combine all this and the ultimate gift is age. Because as you get older, you get slower twitch. And the reason I'm getting better and better at ultras is because I'm just getting that sweet tincture of time thrown at my fast twitch muscle fibers.
Well, this year I'm going to make you a birthday cake for your birthday in June. And it's just going to say type 1 on the birthday with like a bunch of 36 candles, which is how old you'll be turning this year. But actually, as you get back to football, like football definitely gifted you with some intermediate muscle fibers. Like, you know, you did a lot of like heavy lifting and like strength training, really thinking about that. But as you flew into the fence and we're sitting in the hospital in the trauma unit in a neck collar, I was like, thank God for football.
Yeah.
That neck is pretty damn strong.
Yeah, maybe the neck strength had something to do with it. But I don't know. I think the big thing is that I fell into grass. How lucky is that?
Oh, so I mean, also there was grass all over your hospital bed.
Yeah.
Like I'm still finding grass, but it was like a beautiful little pasture of grass.
Yeah. What a good place to die.
No.
To almost die.
What a good place to live.
Right. Okay, let's get on to more news and fun things. The first up I just wanted to mention briefly is Molly Seidel is doing the Canyons 50K. You may have seen her interview on Free Trail. She's been other places too.
Olympic bronze medalist in the marathon coming into trails, which is so cool. And I wonder her mindset. Like she's coming off, she had a patella injury. I think she ruptured her patella tendon, had, I think, a patellar stress fracture. And coming into trails, what do you think her mindset is? Like, I actually, it has to be really hard to be an Olympic bronze medalist coming into a sport that's like still adjacent. And I imagine people have really high expectations for her. And it has to be, I mean, I feel like if you're an Olympic bronze medalist, like you have to have the mindset of like,
yeah,
you know, you're
Caitlin Clark,
a killer mindset. But yeah, I also imagine for her, that's hard in some sense.
Yeah, I imagine it's really hard. I think she's coming in just for fun. This isn't like, you
this
know,
is like a
the Olympics or whatever.
A little training outing. Yeah.
But it gets back to our discussion earlier. I think this is so good for the sport because it'll show more young athletes that this is an option for them and they can skip their track careers if they really want to come straight to trails. There's so much fun to be had here. And I love that she's doing this and applaud her for her courage, but I want to mention it because I think it'll be very cool to be at Canyons and get to, you know, celebrate her journey into the sport, even if it's just for fun.
And it's probably a good race for her too. Like California trails are pretty fast. They're still technical enough that like, it's not going to like, you know, I think the correlation of, you know, running a fast road marathon into a 50K is a little bit less on this type of course, but I'm really curious to see how she does too.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Okay, one more thing that I want to mention before we get to our book recommendation is that I fell for every April Fool's joke last week.
And every single one before your concussion.
I can't use brain trauma as my excuse. The one in particular is Precision Hydration, who we love, released this video of a Pez dispenser for electrolyte tabs. And I've been like, that is the best idea I've ever heard. I've always wanted something like that.
Well, we've always talked about it.
Yeah.
And you fell for it. But actually, my thinking is that we need to do something with these April Fool's jokes because a lot of them are genius.
Yeah.
I'm like, this would be a great entrepreneurial thing. Let's do it.
But like for days later, my algorithm would be showing me things from April 1st. And every single time I fell for it. What is wrong with me, Megan? Like, what is going on?
I think it's just like the part of your brain that has so much love that you're like, yeah.
Okay, yeah, cheer on this thing.
But to be fair, some of these ideas are great. Like I would totally get behind a Precision Pez dispenser.
Yeah. So just know if you did an April Fool's joke out there, I fell for it and I think it's brilliant. So thank you.
Are you going to do one?
An April Fool's joke?
You've never done one.
No, because I don't want to lose people's trust.
That's fair.
Because like there's people on me that do fall for everything and then everyone's acceptable. I actually think April Fool's might be emblematic of a broader range thing on social media and on media in general to not trust anything you see or hear. Yeah.
It's like the scientist, the astrologist that like took a picture of chorizo and was like, it's the night sky.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, you know, The Purge, the idea of The Purge, where in these movies, one day every year, you can commit any crime, right? I'm pretty sure that the rest of the year, the Purge society doesn't do great. Right? Yeah, it's like that one day kind of erodes some trust. I kind of worry that April Fool's is like The Purge, but for how we consume information.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's fair. I buy that.
That means I have thought that The Purge for our deepest, darkest thoughts and comebacks would be wonderful.
That's happening on the dictation right now.
Yes.
As you're dictating notes and I'm standing in the kitchen giving the snarkiest comments that are hopefully not finding their way into dictation.
Oh, so true.
Okay. Actually, it is a reflection though. I feel so comfortable with you.
Yeah.
And I love that. Like, I feel like we have, I mean, we're pretty, this is authentic us on the podcast, but you know, there's like things on here that we can't say.
Yeah.
You know what? I say them in the kitchen sometimes. And I know that you understand that it's coming from a place of love.
Always. Yeah. I just got to watch what pops up on my computer screen. Yeah. Okay. Final thing here is a book recommendation. We talked about this briefly in relation to Strava and social media, but it's called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, a book that has resonated a lot with both of us.
It's so good. And I also, it made me realize that I don't have enough social science in my life. Yeah. Like he covers like the social science behind social media and why it might be hitting like Gen Z, specifically people that were born after like 95.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's just opened my eyes to a lot of ways of thinking and how we're thinking about like parenting and how we're even thinking about like our own social media and screen time use.
Yeah. So it combines two things. One is controlling parenting that started in the 1980s, where kids weren't necessarily allowed to free play as much as a way that kind of lit the fuse. But then what really set the fire in motion was this unsupervised existence on social media and media in general. And so I joked on a few episodes ago that Leo is never getting a smartphone until he graduates high school. And I stand by that.
And you actually made that joke. And I was like, come on, that's going to be like, that's going to put him in like through the social ringer.
Yeah.
And after listening to this book, I agree with you.
Yeah. You got to protect the brain.
Yes. Right?
Yeah. Brain, first of all, just like my experience. But the number two reflection I had is how this also applies to all of us in that we're living these performative lives in just a way that, of course, it's performative when there's any sort of like a relationship is performative to a certain extent until you get past a level of comfort like we were just talking about. And how important it is to make sure that you're also inoculated against the things that cause anxiety and stress from these types of apps.
And I love that you brought up the performative piece because I feel like the struggle with these apps is like when you have likes and when you have like people that are rising to the top in terms of likes, is it often rewards performative behavior that is more extreme.
And you know where I got most likes I've ever gotten in my life?
When you almost died.
When I almost died.
When you're in a neck brace on Instagram.
What a great metaphor.
I know. And I feel like that's the, that is actually, and I hadn't really thought about it before, is that I think when you reward extremism in society, and I feel like you can see it, like it has different challenges. I feel like also too, and you know, Haidt talks about this across genders.
Yeah.
And I feel like I never thought about it in that way of like how we reward extreme behavior. And it's gotten to the point where like, I have thought about how I want to use social media. And I really like, I think I've set a few like boundaries with myself. Yeah. Like one, I'm not going to use my phone really around Leo because I have to take cute pictures of him,
of course.
Very important.
And central.
But then I put it away when I'm like hanging out with Leo. And two is I want to use social media less aside from Strava, because I feel like it, and Haidt posited this in a way that I hadn't thought about before as like opportunity cost.
Yeah.
It's like, we talk about it all the time about like being on screen time, but I never thought about the idea that like when you're on screen time, like, yes, maybe you're on your phone for like 90 minutes a day, but that's 90 minutes that you could be doing something else. Like yeah. I could be reading a book or taking a bath or like, you know, going outside and taking Addie for a walk. And I never really thought about like what I was missing as a result of being on my phone.
Well, I think screen time can be valuable and uplifting.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I mean,
most of my screen time comes from Zwift.
But what I take away from it is less about that for myself personally and more about, I need to make sure that the things I'm taking in are things that lift me up.
Yes.
And I say this to athletes all the time, like the things that we are around in our virtual worlds are just like the real world, and that it becomes our personalities over time.
But I think the app is also programmed to give you things that are extremist. And so it's like, then it's like programming into that reality.
Yeah. And so a great tweet came out this week from @drill, which is one of the all-time most famous Twitter accounts. It's
I didn't know that.
It's what started kind of the, what's the word for painting that's like impressionist? It's very cool types of humor. But his tweet was, "Does anyone know where I could find some unsolicited advice, preferably from people with weird personality disorders who don't know anything?" And that's what social media is. You're performing for those people often, and just need to be careful about it. And I think Strava, athletics, race choices, all of that stuff plays a role here. Like, make sure you're not performing when you're living.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's beautiful. High five.
Okay.
Another high five, carefully. Final reflection point is, are there actions, like for me, I think one, I actually never really use social media that much. And I do feel like I had really good boundaries with it before, but I kind of like, I just don't want to support apps and companies that have made conscious decisions knowingly in the context of mental health and how it impacts like adolescents and young adults.
Yeah.
What are like, are you going to change any of your actions?
I mean, to a certain extent, but I already knew, you know,
the
reason this book is so powerful, I think, is because it gives voice to the things we all know, we all feel.
Yes. In a very eloquent way. Like, I feel like the analogies and examples he gave were excellent.
And I think I was fortunate in some ways in that the dual factors here were not really meant for me. My parents raised me in such a way that I was given tons of freedom very early in everything I did. And so I developed what he called anti-fragility, mm-hmm. where yes, I'm very susceptible to emotional harm, but in terms of like responding to adversity, that's a place where I do kind of step up. And like, it's not the end of the world for me because, you know, I dealt with so many minor adversities as a kid in the freedom I was given. So I love the idea of anti-fragility.
Did you think about that as you were flying into a fence? You're like, this is in the name of anti-fragility.
Well, I mean, what prepared me to deal with that other than football?
Yeah,
right?
That's like, true. Yeah.
Not the sense of getting hit, but the sense of, fuck, this sucks and you got to deal with it and it's okay.
Yeah.
But that being said, I do think that social media affects me like everybody else. And for me, it's just more about the part of not letting it infect me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my big thing is surround myself with people who lift me up. And God, you look at my Instagram or my Strava on the day of the accident, it's like, people were so kind and loving. And it's like, social media can be the most beautiful thing in the world. Like, I got to experience my funeral, essentially. You know, like they say that, like, imagine if you could live your own funeral.
You would have the ballest funeral, like the ballest ass funeral of all time. Like
the attendees,
dancing and love and kindness. I mean, and actually, it's funny because we kind of talked about this last week's episode.
Go through those comments. I mean, it was, I'm like almost crying now. Like, you know, nothing on the episode has made me that emotional since I've already processed all that stuff. But like everyone saying these things that were just like wildly kind about the ways I've touched their lives and people that I've never met even. And I mean, to me, it's like, God, that's the coolest thing on earth. And yes, that's social media. That's the way that happened. So there are good things and bad things. And I want to focus on the good things and not let the bad things drag me down.
That's really beautiful. Yeah. And I feel like it just takes like, I feel like it takes like conscious awareness to be able to do that. And I think this book has helped me so much. Also, we like bonded with our nurse. Our nurse in the, like your nurse in the trauma unit was like listening, was like listening to the book as we were reading the book.
Yeah.
And so we had a little book club in the trauma unit.
Yeah. And then we recommended our podcast. And then he said, I really like Joe Rogan and stuff. And I was like, good. You'll like ours too. Trust me. There's a great overlap. I promise. Okay. On to hot takes. First one, insurance plans should cover the cost of coaching. No further explanation necessary.
I like this one. I think sometimes they do, like, or like companies do, like there's always like kind of like a health service fee that you can use. Yeah. And some people pay for coaching for that.
Yeah. Oh, we'll need to look deeply into our insurance plan after all of the trips.
We're doing
taken.
That now. We actually have a good insurance plan.
Yeah.
They better cover that dream bike.
Maybe that's another lesson. Get the Cadillac insurance plan.
Yeah.
With car or with home, it's always worth it. Yeah. There's never a time when, like, whatever small price you pay in addition, you know, the peace of mind you get when you're flying through the air, yeah. Pretty damn good. Okay.
Do you have life insurance?
I don't. Actually, yeah, you know, I should get it, but...
We should work up. Both of us should do that this
actually,
week.
Actually, I asked you... What you would do. What did you say last night that was so fucking funny?
What I would do if...
Well, about when life insurance, you said, oh yeah, well, I assume if you die, we'll be getting a lot of money from somebody.
Yeah. Well, no, you asked me if I was going to continue the podcast and you're like, and I said,
you got to continue it for the duration of the feed sponsorship.
Megan. I know. And I'm like, I can't do that. Like I literally could not do this without you. And then I was like, you know, I'd make money in other ways.
No, the podcast will continue. You have to promise me. It means a lot to me.
Well, vice versa. But I mean, you've done solo Patreon episodes. I don't know if I can do this without
you.
You
don't have to do solo. You can do it with one of our friends.
No.
Yes. Megan, promise me. I need you to promise me.
Okay, I will promise
you. I'm Jack.
You're looking at me right now with a mangled nose. And so I will promise you.
You're on the door and I'm Jack holding the door in freezing water.
You're like, please podcast.
Continue the podcast without me.
Keep the dick jokes going.
Talk to me like one of your French girls. Okay, let's not do any more hot takes. Let's go straight to Listener Corner. Anything you want to say before we get to Listener Corner?
No, just, well... We should promote something, but before we promote something, I really love you, David, and I'm so glad you're okay.
So we want to promote love.
Yes, promote love, yes.
Use code SWAP at checkout, and you get lots of love. No, we love you all, too. And like Megan, it's telling that when I woke up, I was so fixated on you. And you have made my life worth living, and you've made it feel like I'm flying every day. So thank you. You prepared me for that flight.
Well, there's been so many moments since, especially when you're with Leo, like last night. So you typically like put Leo to bed every night, and I've had to help you with it now because like you can't put Leo into his crib. Like it's complicated.
Yeah.
But like I take these like mental images of you with Leo or you like you doing things in life. And it's like such a gift to freeze time in my brain and be like, oh my God, this is a miracle. This is amazing. And I love you so much.
Okay. Well, you know what else I love?
What?
Athletic Greens.
I know. I was like, tie it into the greens. Do it.
Drinkag1.com/swap.
Well, this is our life insurance.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we actually legitimately like this stuff. I made Megan bring it to the hospital. And I was like, I need everything on board. I was like, bring the ketones, bring the athletic greens. I don't care if they say this is okay. So drinkag1.com/swap. If you go there, you get free vitamin D, travel packs. It's good shit.
I do think it's helped with your brain recovery.
Something has.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know.
It's magic sauce. At least we think it helps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel shockingly good. I got to be honest. Like, you know, maybe it will turn soon, but, you know, I felt good. I mean, I've been able to run actually like 2 days of 8 mile runs. And
did you know you've said that 3 times in this episode?
Oh, no.
No, your brain is good. I promise. You have crushed this podcast.
It's so good. On the Listener Corner, sending a big thank you to Megan for the openness and vulnerability, which she's talked about her health issues over the past few years. I've always appreciated it. But it took a new meaning for me at the start of this year when my body fell apart and my mental health went with it. In those first few weeks, sometime after the initial panic over potential heart issues started to fade, Megan talked on the podcast about the journey back to big girl workouts and going into canyons okay with whatever happened. Then she won a race and another. That stuck with me. Now, when things get scary, I remind myself to be more like Megan and enjoy the adventures as they come. It's still scary, but at least there's hope on the other side. So just a note of thanks. I really, really appreciate it. P.S. You were right. The heart rate monitor chest patch glue is next level stuff.
Oh, for this listener. And I feel like for anyone out there, there is usually some kind of hope on the other side. And I don't know. I feel like there's also so much meaning when you go through something and you can look at that hope and be like, damn, I deserve that.
You know one thing I thought about?
What?
Boulder Community Hospital must think our family is doing really weird stuff.
No, you know what? I feel like this is just par for the course.
I guess it is.
Yeah, this is just life, you know, in existence, and it happens. And sometimes it's like when you put yourself out there and dream big, you're going to have more hospital visits, you know? And I think that's just like the reality of living.
Yeah. I don't want to live a small life.
No.
You know? And small lives are safer. There's still risks, right? But they're safer. And I don't want to. I want to live big, you know? Like, and maybe that's different than something I would have said when I was young, when I'm like, I just want to help people and do all that. It's like, no, I want to experience as much as I can. You know, life is short, life is impermanent. And, you know, if that ends from getting hit by a truck, then, you know, at least I wasn't just like waiting to some time that's never going to come where I'll actually be like experiencing the world and fulfilled. So, you know, if nothing else, this taught me that maybe some non-consensual flight is a small price to pay for getting to live a big life.
Well, do you know what was a price that you didn't have to pay?
What?
Your Coros arm monitor. This person is talking about like super gluing a chest strap heart rate monitor to themselves. This must have been before the arm heart monitor of Coros. And you know what? They saved it from you. They cut everything off, but somehow they like rolled off the heart rate monitor.
And my watch.
Yeah.
Everything is safe.
Everything is really safe.
Good. Yeah. And to this listener, we love you so much. Heart stuff is scariest of all, right? And whenever it starts to touch one of those vital organs, things get really dicey. And just know that you're going to come out of this stronger, happier, and faster than ever. That's the big thing that is really hard to see is when you're in the doldrums, like in what I've seen from Megan is that it's impossible sometimes to think that you're going to be faster than ever. Like I told you on this podcast many times, you're going to come back and be stronger than ever. And it sounded like bullshit, I think even to you. But you know what? I'm right.
I feel it. Well, I do feel fast and I'm ready. I'm honestly ready for whatever happens at Canyons. I just want to get there and run and have you crewing me with one arm.
The edible underwear are getting ready. School of Hogwarts written right across the front. We love you all.
Woohoo!
Huzzah.